This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and guests about politics. It's Friday, June 11th. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. Late last month, Naomi Osaka, the second-ranked women's tennis player in the world, announced that she would not speak to the press during the French Open, one of the biggest tournaments. Press conferences are seen as obligatory for players at major events, but Osaka said that they were affecting her mental health and her performance. The French Open's referee fined her $15,000 for not participating, and the leaders of the four Grand Slam tournaments threatened her with harsher penalties. In response, Osaka withdrew from the tournament, issuing a statement saying that the truth is I have suffered long bouts of depression since the U.S. Open in 2018, and I have had a really hard time coping with that. Osaka's withdrawal from the French Open has brought further attention to the power dynamics of professional sports, where wealthy league bosses, the media, and fans can exert tremendous pressure on players. Even the most famous players in the world aren't exempt from those tensions. In a press conference following the first round of the French Open, Serena Williams expressed sympathy for Osaka.
The only thing I feel is that I feel for Naomi. I feel like I wish I could give her a hug because I know what it's like. Like I said, I've been in those positions. We have different personalities, and people are different. Not everyone is the same. I'm thick, you know, other people are thin. So everyone is different and everyone handles things differently. So, you know, you just have to let her handle it the way she wants to in the best way that she thinks she can. And that's the only thing I can say. I think she's doing the best that she can.
Louisa Thomas, a New Yorker staff writer, joins me to discuss Naomi Osaka and how athletes are using their fame and visibility to reshape professional sports. Hi, Louisa. So good to talk to you.
It's so great to be here.
So Osaka decides she doesn't want to talk to the press. And on the face of it, that doesn't seem so controversial. She's a tennis player there to play, not to give interviews. So how did this decision lead to her withdrawing from one of the biggest events in her sport?
Well, I think it's pretty clear from her second statement and also probably from the tone of her first statement that she didn't expect that this was going to be such a big deal either. It's actually not unheard of for tennis players to opt out of press conferences, although they are obligatory. When you enter a tournament, you sign a contract like you do doing anything else, and that also includes certain responsibilities to engage with the press if there are any requests. And for a player of Naomi Osaka's stature, there are always requests. So that said, players often opt out and just take a fine. In fact, after a loss in Rome, Naomi Osaka didn't do a press conference and nobody really noticed. Venus Williams is sort of famous for skipping press conferences, particularly after losses. It was the decision to preemptively announce it and also to sort of make a political statement, to sort of use her platform to call attention to this issue of how the dynamic between the press and the players work. And there was a huge response. I mean, a pretty bipolar response. I mean, some people were very, very sympathetic with her and very much supportive of her, you know, taking the stance and saying that she's doing a tremendous things for people, mental health issues and, you know, exerting her agency and power. And other people were, you know, saying, come on, you know, she is the highest paid female athlete in the world. And she signed a contract and, you know, this is part of the job. So yeah, it was a very, very divisive issue. And yeah, she withdrew. I think at that point, it really was a kind of mental health crisis. I can only imagine that it was.
Race plays a big issue here too. You've written that Osaka's famous only partly because she's good at the game. She's young, she's Black and Asian, and she speaks openly about her politics. Could you explain her significance both inside and outside tennis?
You know, one thing that's interesting here, and it's complex and pretty nuanced, is that one of the reasons she's so famous is that she is so good at using her platform and using the attention that she gets to draw attention to some of these bigger issues, including police brutality. Last year before the U.S. Open, she wore the name of a victim of police brutality on her mask before each round. She went on to win the tournament, so that was You know, that was a lot of attention that she was able to call during the Wildcat strike by the Milwaukee Bucks, which sort of triggered this domino effect of teams sort of shutting down for a day last August. She also opted not to play. I mean, certain players like Venus Williams has been very outspoken about race as well, but Osaka sort of took that a step further. And that has been part of her meteoric rise. It's not just that she is on her best day, and especially on hard court, you know, the best tennis player in the world. It's also that she is such an eloquent voice and that she is very, very good with the press. That includes me. I've profiled her a couple of times and have always found her to be unfailingly polite and interesting and thoughtful. And you know, she is very eager to say that she is shy too. She has seen that way as well.
She is the highest paid female athlete in history, I believe, yet she is beholden to the people who run the league she plays in, as are many other rich and famous athletes. How has that relationship historically worked?
Historically, well, you know, women's tennis is a little bit different than other sports leagues, I would say. I'm going to just bracket that point because I'm going to come back to it. Historically, in American team sports, owners have the power. You know, they're the ones who are negotiating the big TV contracts. They get this, you know, the big salaries. And in the NBA, for instance, or in the NFL, it's a franchise system where there's a draft and you are told where you're going to play. And there are certain kind of limits on how much money you can make and what kind of demands you can make on where you want to play and things like that. And recently that's been shifting. And that's largely because a few athletes, LeBron James is, you know, the first name that comes to mind, have really kind of started to stand up and say, wait a second, you know, we are the talent. We are the people who are responsible for the attention. And we deserve some say in things like where we're going to play and, you know, what under what conditions we're going to talk to the media and how we're going to use our platforms and things like that. So there is a major shift in sports, and it is a little bit of a power struggle at the moment. My colleague Isaac Chotiner recently wrote a piece about Rich Paul, LeBron James's agent. And, you know, there's a quote from an anonymous GM who it says basically players have all the power now and it's terrible for sports. Tennis is a little bit different because it's a sport of independent contractors. And women's tennis in particular is a little bit different because there is this legacy of let's call it player empowerment. You know, if you look back to the early days of the WTA, is a Billie Jean King and a group of women decided to opt out of the system as it was and create their own tour. And that has meant tremendously good things for women, women's tennis, and I would argue women in general. You know, women's tennis is the only major sport in which there is equal pay at the very top, at the Grand Slams. That's not true across the board at regular tour events, but it is true at a place like Wimbledon or at the French Open. And it makes it possible for someone like Naomi Osaka to make, you know, more than $50 million a year in endorsements. That's just not true in any other sport, even women's soccer, where, you know, the women are tremendously popular. Women's tennis has a tradition of you know, players being a little bit more empowered. But even there, you know, tournament directors exert some control. And I think one of the things we saw was some fear from the tournaments, you know, recognizing that they do make their money based on the attention that these players get. And Naomi Osaka is one of the most charismatic and interesting and compelling athletes around. And if she's saying, I'm not going to meet with the press, why is the press going to be sending reporters? Why are they going to be covering the tournament? You know, I think that they sense that, you know, tennis is a somewhat marginal sport and they want to shine the light on her as brightly as possible. And if she's saying, look, I'm not about that, you know, that's a problem for the tournament.
You recently wrote about Athletes Unlimited, which is a new network of women's leagues that sees putting players first as the key to a sport's mainstream success. Maybe tell us a little bit more about that.
Sure. Athletes Unlimited was born out of a kind of confluence of circumstances, but these two people, including John Patrickoff, who had been a president of a major league soccer team, who sort of realized there was a disconnect between the fact that certain female professional athletes, like people like Megan Rapinoe, have tremendous name brand appeal, let's say, and a huge following and huge attention. And yet nobody really knows that the fact that she plays for the OL Reign in Seattle. I mean, even people who would probably call themselves great Megan Rapinoe fans probably don't know about her domestic pro league. And that just made sort of no sense to him. And Jonathan Soros is, you know, the son of George Soros, has also been thinking a long time about how to sort of reconfigure the sort of traditional management labor divide. And so they started talking and they came up with this new idea for a new league that sort of capitalizes on the attention to individual athletes, which is particularly true probably of female athletes. But the fact that, you know, as someone like LeBron James has his own fans, you know, there are Lakers fans, but there are also LeBron James fans who are willing to follow him around. And that's even more true of women's sports. Someone like might not be even a fan of tennis, but they might be a fan of Naomi Osaka. And so it's building around that model. You know, it's a really intriguing idea. And once I started investigating in this league, you know, so many interesting and I think very urgent questions about how we value women's sports and how we value, you know, entertainment and how we value social issues started arising. And I sort of, you know, saw all these kind of roads forking, and it's been really kind of interesting to follow where some of them go.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit newyorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
In soccer, where female athletes are often more famous and successful than their male peers, are paid far less to play. We've all gotten used to hearing that Americans just don't want to watch women play professional sports. But that's changing, yes?
That's changing. It may not even have ever been true, partly because we don't know. I mean, because women's sports were not shown on network TV in the way that, you know, men's sports are. On a Sunday afternoon in October, you can turn on the TV and the NFL will be on Fox. But traditionally, it has not been easy to watch women's sports. So it's a little bit of a chicken and the egg problem. It was very easy to say people didn't want to watch women's sports because it was almost impossible to watch women's sports. You know, in the beginning, the NWSL, the Women's Professional Domestic League, had a television contract. The weekly game was on Lifetime, and nobody was watching. It was so disastrous, actually, that the contract was terminated early. And for a while, there was no television contract, and you sort of had to download the Yahoo app to watch. And it was really low production value. And guess what? Ratings were bad. Recently, you know, someone at CBS made the very smart decision to say, like, look, there's so much energy around the national team. Why don't we try putting a game on CBS? And guess what? 500,000 people watched. And those numbers have been sustained. Viewership is way up, and they're finding that in sport after sport. The more NCAA women's basketball tournaments games were on ESPN, the more people were watching. True of ABC as well. This has been true of right now. The Women's College World Series is going on, and you know, there was a game recently that 1.65 million people watched. They're averaging over 1 million fans. That's the same as the College World Series. So it's not actually necessarily true that people don't want to watch sports. It has been true that it's been very difficult to watch women's sports, and the numbers have reflected that.
Other countries seem to have come to this revelation earlier than the United States. Don't some athletes make up to 10 times the salary playing abroad?
The short answer is yes, but that's actually a little bit misleading, because it's not that these teams always have these huge natural audiences. In other countries, there's a little bit more of an ego thing. Like in Russia, you know, these oligarchs will basically own their own teams. And it's a little bit, one agent described to me, one particularly famous owner was sort of a collector. And this was like part of his collection. He also collected statues and things like that. And he had a women's basketball team, and he owned a mine. I might be getting this wrong, but he had a mine, and you know, he would actually pay employees to go watch games. So it's not that there was this kind of like, oh, they realize how awesome women's sports were. Although I think that, again, if you go to a game, a lot of people got into it, and there really were huge fans, but it wasn't that they had better access in that sense. It was more a kind of the dynamic was very different. And similarly in Italy, you know, there are certain leagues that have like lots of different levels, tiers of team. It's not like, let's say, the NFL, where there's sort of like one level of game. It's more like
well, there might be a team where they have a women's team and an elite team and a second tier team and a youth team. And so that, you know, kind of generates income and more of that goes to the women's side. So it's not necessarily that, you know, other countries are more enlightened. It's just a very kind of different system. But yes, the answer is that a lot of basketball players and volleyball players and people in other sports, soccer players, traditionally have to go overseas. But yeah, I mean, you can go overseas to Russia and you get a driver and you get an apartment and you get $1 million salary. But it's also very weird because, again, like, fans are sort of being flown around to follow you. But it's a little bit of a weird system.
Last summer, you profiled Nneka Ogumike, a star player in the WNBA and the president of its players' union. She helped negotiate a major collective bargaining agreement last year. And during last summer's protests, she very savvily balanced the players' concerns about social justice and the pandemic with their desire to get on the court. Are there any broad lessons to be drawn from her example?
Yeah, I mean, I think that this collective bargaining agreement negotiated between the players' union and the WNBA is on the one hand a model for women's sports. It was remarkably uncontentious. It also happened at a particular moment in history that is unlikely to be repeated. It's pre-pandemic. There was a new commissioner. There was a lot of momentum for women's sports that both sides very savvily recognized. And there was a real sense of collaboration. And there were some issues on which they're really kind of fought, but they came up with some creative solutions to come to this really kind of tremendous place. And the WNBA players have never been shy about, you know, saying that we are more than athletes. Some of them, I think Nneka said to me something like, you know, we don't have a choice. We are political because no one will let us be otherwise. You know, they are Black women in a world that doesn't traditionally value Black women. And so for them to get anything traditionally, they've sort of had to make a kind of political statement, whether they want to or not. And increasingly they want to, and they are doing it in this kind of amazingly effective way. Even before it, you know, during the George Floyd protests, they created a social justice council in collaboration with the league. That's something that the NBA players had to go through these kind of like agonizing meetings to get to 4 months later. You know, LeBron James kind of famously called Barack Obama, and Barack Obama said, start a social justice council. And I sort of laughed, and he was like, he just should have called Nneka Ogumike. He would have gotten the answer a little bit more easily. You know, I think that they are very savvy. They're aware of their power, and they're also kind of interestingly aware of the limitations of their power, which make them pretty effective, I think. And they're pretty smart about, you know, recognizing that unity is important, but also having these internal conversations so they can get to a point in which they can be united. It's quite a well-known story now, but one of the owners of the Atlanta Dream, Kelly LaFleur, was running for Senate, and she was embracing Trump on the way and using her team as a kind of political prop to sort of denigrate Black Lives Matter. And they decided to support Warnock, her opponent, and that that came at a critical moment and kept the attention on him. And I think they recognize that they do have a lot of power, and that their power extends beyond, you know, increasing their bank accounts, but, you know, that is important too. But they're really thoughtful about the way they use it. And it's been really kind of impressive to watch them.
So the Tokyo Olympics, which will begin in a little over a month, have been mired in controversy. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about the major issues and what kinds of political actions you're expecting to see as athletics kind of returns to the global stage.
That's actually a kind of interesting question, because there is the very obvious major issue of the pandemic. Tokyo is still in a state of emergency, and bringing people from around the world into a country where very few people are vaccinated, volunteers have been pulling out. A vast, vast majority of residents say they do not want the Olympics to happen. Various groups, including sponsors and doctors groups, have said that they also believe the Olympics should not happen. This is a very much too big to fail situation. They are loath. They've said repeatedly the Olympics are basically happening no matter what at this point. And I think that the athletes are going to be in the uncomfortable position of nobody wants to be responsible for the death of anyone. And no athletes, I think, by going to Japan should, you know, no one should accuse them of that. But yeah, it's a very, very difficult situation. And then there's On top of that, layered on top of that, the Olympics have a tradition of maintaining this kind of false or not apolitical stance. Protests have traditionally been outlawed at the Olympics. And those few moments, we can think of, you know, Tommy Smith and John Carlos, where athletes have protested on the medal stands have been controversial and explicitly against the rules. And that's been relaxing a little bit, but I believe it's still a rule that they can't protest on the medal stand. But we're going to see a sort of confrontation between this kind of movement and athletes' empowerment and the image that the IOC wants to project of being apolitical and, you know, united and a place where athletes and of all countries from all types of government come together in the spirit of, you know, peace and collaboration and all that. But yeah, so it's against this tremendously difficult backdrop too.
Thank you so much, Louisa.
Thank you.
Louisa Thomas is a staff writer at The New Yorker, where she covers sports. She's the author of 3 books and a co-editor of Losers, Dispatches from the Other Side of the Scoreboard. This has been The Political Scene. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on newyorker.com. Feel free to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Our theme music is by Russell Gillespie. This program was produced by Alex Barron and Kylie Warner for newyorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.